I was sort of booking Dream for the show, and I was like asking, hey, would you like to please be on the thing? She's like, do you remember we met at the going to the border? I was like, yeah, I also remember that you saw me bomb in Detroit in front of 20 people.
Bomb because they're 20 people.
I was like, maybe she's forgotten about it. You know, that was a different dude. Yeah, no, but so
same hair. Yeah. It's great to see someone have Frederick Douglass hair on television today.
From First Look Media and Panoply, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kundabolu.
The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
Even though Frank Ocean didn't release his album last week, you can listen to two men who are just as handsome and whose voices are just as beautiful. Two men? Would they clone me?
Today we're talking to writer, filmmaker, and social justice activist Dream Hampton. And that's a bio that doesn't even get close to everything she's doing. She dropped so many mics in this episode.
She's written for Vibe Magazine, The Source, The Village Voice, Life and Times, and of course, the Internet. She's known for writing about hip-hop, social justice, and was an early Twitter adopter.
She's often described as your favorite rapper's favorite writer. And in 2014... Jay-Z stood with her and other celebs to advocate for prison reform in California.
Rock 47, California. Build more schools, less prison. More schools, less prison, California. They'll never be able to stop us.
On today's show, we'll talk to Dream about the potential power of celebrity activism, the strengths but also challenges of liberation movements, and the price of being a critical woman of color today. Spoiler alert, Twitter is a shitty place.
We'll also find out who Dream thinks has the better hair, Hari or me.
She was just being polite, Kamau.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. Hey, everybody. Today's podcast is the first in a series of things we're calling The Redford Recordings.
The Redford Recordings.
These were recorded when we were at Sundance at the Creative Change Retreat for the Opportunity Agenda. We talked to lots of amazing people. We have a lot of amazing conversations that are coming out of there. And by a lot, I mean like three.
they were really good three.
But it felt like six.
Yeah, there's some powerful stuff in there and also some really hilarious stuff.
So yeah, we have several conversations that came out of that that we're sharing with you. And this one with Dream Hampton is a biggie. Pun intended.
It's juicy, pun intended.
It's got 99 No, it doesn't have any problems.
No, it's really good.
So just a quick note, you'll hear Dream reference things that happened that day, and I don't want you to be confused. This podcast was recorded again on July 20th, so it's a little bit in the Wayback Machine, but still totally relevant. Because Dream knows everybody, has done a lot of things, and like a Johnny Cash song, she's been everywhere, we decided that instead of interrupting the podcast every few seconds with...
Hold up, wait a minute.
That we would do something we haven't done before called...
The Politically Reactive Glossary of Terms.
So along with Black Lives Matter, you'll hear Dream mention a couple of other organizations involved deeply in the work for the movement for Black Lives, BYP, also known as BYP 100, also known as the Black Youth Project, and Million Hoodies. Both organizations were formed in the wake of Trayvon Martin's death and George Zimmerman's acquittal, and they're both doing big work. Check them out.
When she mentions DeRay, she's talking about DeRay McKesson, an activist considered one of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. He moved to Ferguson following the protest there after Michael Brown was killed. He has a huge social media presence, wears a signature blue puffy Patagonia vest, and also unsuccessfully ran for mayor of Baltimore recently. He also went to Bowdoin College with me, which is why I stay quiet when Dream mentions him.
Dream also mentions Octavia Butler, a highly acclaimed, extremely legendary African-American female science fiction writer who died in 2006. She is the first science fiction writer ever to win a MacArthur Genius Grant. And she was very inspirational to my cousin, N.K. Jemison, who's a fantasy writer who also has won awards. Family plug.
John Brown was a white American abolitionist in the 1800s who was in favor of an armed slave rebellion because he didn't think there was a peaceful resolution. He led a raid on an armory in Virginia in 1859 to do just that. It was ultimately unsuccessful. 7 people were killed. He was captured and hanged by the state. I have a feeling he was out of his mind.
So, Hari, while we're in the glossary, could you please explain to me who Nas, Mace, Biggie, and Jay-Z are?
Who doesn't know who Nas, Mace, Biggie, and Jay-Z are? Like, these are our fans, right? They would probably know this.
Hari, just humor me. My in-laws might be listening.
Okay. Nas is a legendary rapper from Queens, New York, specifically the Queensbridge neighborhood. He made the classic album Illmatic. Mace was a piece of Puff Daddy's human jewelry and also rapped. Biggie, also known as the Notorious B.I.G. or Big Papa, was from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, New York, arguably the greatest rapper of all time. If you're from Brooklyn and you've seen things on a Brooklyn Industry t-shirt that says spread love the Brooklyn way, yeah, that's referring to Biggie and is a sign that white demons have moved into your neighborhood. He was also murdered at a very young age in 1997. Vanilla Ice, still alive. And finally, Jay-Z is, come on, man. Really? Do I got to explain Jay-Z? Come on.
He's Beyonce's husband. That's the easiest way to explain it.
Yeah, so we could have had my mom define Jay-Z then.
And that's today's politically reactive glossary of terms. Now let's get to the interview. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do you prefer to be called Godhead? Or is there a preferred Her Excellency?
The most honorable.
The most honorable Dream Hampton?
Small D, small H.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I feel like there's so many conversations to have with you.
Yeah.
It's funny, we've all convened at this Opportunity Agenda, Creative Change, you know, with a bunch of artists and activists. And there's a point at which everybody goes around and says what they do or what they are known for. And how do you identify yourself, Dream Hampton?
As a filmmaker, writer, and organizer from Detroit. I had the shortest bio out of all of you guys.
I know. And you do that on purpose to make the rest of us look bad for
I
kind of am in a multidimensional artist space where I'm sort of a stand-up comedian and also I work in television, but also I'm really kind of an activist, but also an online, like you just make us all, the rest of us feel dumb.
I just don't like to talk about myself that much.
But yeah. The thing is, you're actually a real, like Renaissance person, because I feel there's a lot of people who claim that, like, well, I'm a blogger and I'm an activist and I have the Etsy store and I'm a kickball champion, and it's like, that's not a real. Yeah. Like, you actually do many things well in many different spaces.
I don't know about well, but I do them. I mean, my Twitter bio used to just say pilot, you know, because I'm a pilot.
What?
Yeah.
You can fly a plane?
Single and twin engine. Yeah.
When did you find time to do that?
I went to flight school and I learned how to be a pilot. I don't own a plane, so it's hard to practice this hobby. But a long time ago, when I was in like the Nation of Islam or whatever.
That's a footnote that will also just be.
Okay. They used to be like, what's your skill? What's your skill? Like, you can't write your way, you know, into the revolution or whatever. Like, imagining you know, or it's an Octavia Butler question. Like, what's your post-apocalyptic skill? You know, and people say like super like obtuse stuff. Like, I'm a healer, and I'm like, I don't know if I want
you
in my cadre.
From the Harvard Medical School of Healing.
Even if you do, I don't want you in my cadre unless you can tell us what plants not to eat and what, you know. So anyway, mine was, I was like, I'm going to be a pilot.
It's funny that is an important thing. What is your post-apocalyptic skill?
We don't have any, dude.
I know, you feel like I'll be the funny guy. Nope.
Nope. Never been that guy.
Nope. Plus, sense of humor doesn't actually not needed at that moment.
No. No.
Do you know which crops to plant when? That's what you need to know.
People later are like, oh, remember how they come up? They were funny.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, they were also delicious.
My first real sort of getting to know you in a direct way, which is funny to say, is Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, when I first arrived at Twitter, there was just like a handful of people that it was like, well, these are the people you need to sort of keep up with, and you were one of those people.
Okay.
And it was just like, so I would see these tweets, and it was just like, it was always like, about the revolution and about hip hop and how those things intertwine.
I hardly ever tweeted about hip hop, but I was one of those yeah, people who has always cared about justice and probably is perpetually outraged or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I'm real good at, you know, that's a good lane for me is outrage. And that is Twitter's whole lane. Yes. And so, yeah, early on, it was a good fit. I remember getting 50,000 followers and like ending my account and starting over because I knew even then, like how dangerous visibility is, mm-hmm. how not fun it is. I've had friends, I don't know why, I don't know who I was in a past life that I have to be friends with people who happen to be highly visible. But I always have throughout my life. And so it's never been tempting to me to be visible. Mm-hmm. I would say that my friend Biggie would be alive if he weren't visible. And I'd prefer him. I like that he's a rap icon and whatever, he hasn't died in some ways. But I would prefer to like roll up with him right now and smoke. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so I've always, so on there, that's like the very serious example of someone dying from their mm-hmm. visibility, which he literally did. And then just all the, it's just not good for anything, you know?
Is it not good for anything or is it not good for your needs?
Oh, well, it's definitely not good for my needs. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure, aren't you dealing with that? Like, how do you negotiate visibility?
You should totally delete all your Twitter followers and start over.
Oh, you'd like that, wouldn't you?
No, I'm just saying that would be good for you. I think like that's, yeah. You know, or maybe it's not for everybody, but I think you should definitely do it.
It's a Buddhist exercise.
I don't know that my agent, my manager, my lawyer, my college rep, my book agent.
Get rid of all of them. Come on.
I do understand what you're saying, and I do. But to be truthful, is like I am in this space now of like becoming more visible and aware, very, very clearly aware of when I want it, when I don't want it, mm. right. and also how it affects in a very profound way my children. I might be able to take being too visible, but my kids haven't made that choice.
Well, that was the first time I've left Twitter like 40 something times, but but the last time last August really was the last time for me. I mean, it had been 7 years. At the top of the year, I said I was going to leave, and I just faced too many mobs, you know. Mm. But one of the earliest mobs was around my daughter, and I probably should have left then. Like, I stay playing myself. Like, I even played myself in that situation. I didn't know. I always forget that, like. And I hope it's not true anymore. Hopefully I don't mean anything to most people, but I would tweet something and somehow it would have like some nuclear effect or whatever. Mm-hmm. So even engaging the people who were calling my daughter ugly mm-hmm. because she had taken a picture standing next to Beyonce, which I wish had never migrated from Facebook to wherever it migrated to. You know, she was 16 at the time. And so I engaged the person who called her ugly, and then the entire beehive, like, you know, tens of thousands of them started doing it. And so I played myself.
Going against that person or?
No, against me.
Oh,
right.
Wow.
So against my daughter. So I really have dealt with the things that I get called, I can mostly take. I've been mm-hmm. called them way before social media. if you're a woman who like has an opinion, if you're a critical person, and I'm all those things, then yes. You're absolutely, you know, I've been getting like rape letters since the source, like since 1990, yeah, back yeah. when you used to have to write them with a pen.
Oh, yes, and, like, and get an address and a stamp and an yes. envelope, and you had to really be committed to your hate.
And write multiple, yeah. write multiple drafts.
Yeah, you'd have to like, let me start over.
No, real penmanship coming out of the prisons.
Yeah.
and yeah, I mean, so it's rarely about, you know, me. You know, I also... So my other things, like being in things with like Nas or DeRay, like I was just out there. and again, played myself. I should have never said the thing I said about Nas, but it was absolutely true. I'll never back yeah. away from that.
Hold up, wait a minute.
So what Dream is referring to is a 2012 Twitter exchange where somebody asked her, is Jay really that concerned with losing money that he can't just say, fuck my image and make an untitled nigger album like Nas? Nigger is the title of Nas's album. It's also called Untitled. And Dream responds, I think Jay writes what he believes. Nas's nigger album was largely written by Stick of Dead Prez and Jay Electronica. And the hip-hop world went kaboom!
To clarify, what she's saying is someone else wrote Nas's rhymes and hip-hop. That's not a thing that people like. You know, it's disrespectful to claim somebody, you know, wrote your raps, even if it's true.
And especially if you're somebody like Nas, who is known for being a lyricist. So to say that somebody else wrote his lyrics, that'll get you in trouble on the internet, which it got Dream in trouble.
And I absolutely have a critique of, you know, individuals like DeRay kind of self-appointing themselves leaders of the movement, mm-hmm. you know, at the expense of the labor of like women, yes. you know. And back then people, they thought I was like defending this like so-called founders of BLM, but I wasn't. It was about Tia Oso, who's here with us today, who had interrupted Bernie and forced him to write a platform yes. on racial justice. And then these two sisters in Seattle, who BLM, quite frankly, threw under the bus, who interrupted Bernie. Yeah. So these three black women had made all this space, and DeRay kind of slid right in and was like, hey, Bernie, when are we having lunch? You know, as you can see, I have 200,000 Twitter followers, you know, and of course the Bernie digital person responded. So, I mean, those two situations, I was facing like beloved black men, and I had like said something critical.
I mean, you know, compared to DeRay, uh-huh. you've been around. I mean, DeRay sort of popped out of nowhere for most black people. He became like, you know, a cult figure very quickly. And I mean, mm-hmm. like not cult leader, but like a suddenly like it was a cult of personality.
Right.
Whereas to me, that's well, the part.
And he also branded himself.
Yes, he branded himself. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like this is the part that, I mean, speaks to anti-woman feelings and people having feelings about strong black women. Like it feels to me like, why would we not take your opinion seriously knowing that we have that you've been around?
Well, this is why I left. This is why I like took my little ball and left. Not that anyone cares. I mean, I was like, because what he then said, I said, yo, I was snarky. I was like, while a meeting with you and Barney would be a blast, you know, he should meet with the women who made this platform possible. And again, I wasn't talking about Alicia Garza, Opal, and Patrice. I was talking about these three other black women who had interrupted Bernie and who paid and sometimes great cost for it. So the hive mind thing has been great for some things like movement building, you know, even in the abstract, and has been like really lazy in other ways.
But you, because like I said, when I joined Twitter, you'd already been there. So you're on the front lines for the rest of us who are like, don't make that mistake.
No, it's true. And then when people had, you know, valid criticisms, as we should have of each other in this movement, then they all got shut down or people were just afraid. They're like, I don't want to be the next one on that summer stage screen.
Yeah, oh, that's exactly it.
You know, and that's, you know, and that's just what it is. So big mistake.
Your niggas gonna learn to respect the king. Don't be the next contestant on that summer jam screen.
Is there ever a thought about, like when you were talking to DeRay and you were having this like public back and forth, mm-hmm. the idea that like people are seeing the inner workings of a movement, mm-hmm. which, and before, like these conversations would have happened in back rooms or people would never see these arguments or discussions publicly. And for the first time, everyone's seeing them. Like, does it feel weird? Because this is a new era. This is a new thing where you can actually see people you respect who are part of a movement disagreeing publicly.
I mean, well, they would say, I mean, this is a generation that tosses around words like transparency and accountability when they don't really have the mechanisms. What we lack. So black people in particular, we tend to idealize Jews. Like, we need to be unified like Jewish people. We need to put our money together. Jews don't never be fighting.
You need people to do the same thing.
I'm like, are you kidding? Like, yeah. I mean, you know, Tel Aviv used to be, not so more much anymore now that the Likud has been there for a generation and the whole kind of society has gone to the right. But, you know, that used to be a place of great dissent, great like back and forth, huge debates about every aspect of everything, you know, how religion was practiced, about the occupation of Palestine, like all of these conversations should be publicly debated, you know, by secular Jews, non-secular, super Orthodox. It was like a whole thing. So we have these like myths of who people are, and then we say we need to be unified. We don't got no black unity. It's like, no, it never exists for anyone. Like, what we need are better tools for conflict. Yeah. Also, I'm sure Jews are like, I'm sure you don't want to go through what we went through
to get here. To get to whatever this unity
and
looks
whatever
like.
Whatever you think this unity is not true. Like, stop acting like there was ever a time. We wouldn't have Shakespeare, which you guys know is a woman, right?
What?
Yes. Man, you don't know that? Yeah, really? You and your 100,000 followers, nobody informed you about Shakespeare being a woman?
The Swan of Avon. I'm not even kidding. You should absolutely read that book. She was a Jewish aristocratic woman who was trying to write the first important works in English. In fact, the only evidence that we have of William Shakespeare being alive are some receipts that he signed, like in terms of his handwriting.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a whole nother thing.
This is why when she says filmmaker, what is it? The three things you say, filmmaker, writer. What's the other one?
I'm absolutely not an Elizabethan scholar.
But yeah, here we go. This is what I'm saying. We go like, I'm a filmmaker and a writer.
It makes
and,
Shakespeare and love a lot more interesting.
There you
now.
Go. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, politics, and so. The sonnets. I mean, when we look at her sonnet, their sonnets, we, you know, there's all this evidence that Shakespeare might have been queer, which might have been interesting. But it turns out, no, Shakespeare was a woman.
Wow. I knew we were going to break it down today, but I wasn't prepared to the level to which we got.
But again, the older white people who might listen to the show are like, finally, something we can understand. Shakespeare. Sonnets.
Yes, yes. No more white supremacy. That white was supreme. So the thing that I wonder about, because I certainly have my own feelings about this, the struggle to be a public person and the struggle to be a part of these movements and to sort of find yourself in these movements. And you, because you are a public persona, but there's clearly an act, you actively sort of keep, you control that line of how public you are.
Right.
And I see some of that is because when you get too public, people start to come after you because of all sorts of internalized.
No, I'm not built for the public. Also, yeah. I mean, there's also,
but you haven't pulled yourself completely out. You know what I mean? There's this sort of.
I hope that I have. I mean, you know,
then maybe you can't is the question. You've already built up too much credit. You've already done too much that you maybe can't ever pull yourself out.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. I believe in setting your reputation on fire and, you know, and starting over again too. You know, I think. Like, some of this stuff can be distracting. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I wonder if you think about it too. But, you know, I, since I was about 7 or 8, have wanted to make films, you know, and that's all I've ever wanted to do. And sometimes I look at someone like Ava DuVernay, who just made a feature documentary, quietly, Beyonce style, on prisons. And I actually felt envy. I was like, wow, I should have done that. Instead, I was working on the issue of prisons. But she's so thoroughly, and she did a pivot. She didn't want to be a filmmaker since she was 8, you know, or maybe she did, but she was a publicist mm-hmm. for a long time. And I know that people understood me as a journalist, but even when I began writing, I was in film school. And I think about all the ways along the way that I've got distracted from being an artist, which is the first and foremost thing that I am. It's how I see the world. I see the world visually. I'm an aesthete, you know? So, and I'm totally happy for Ava. Like, I had a party when she won the first Black woman to win the Sundance Directors Award for what I think is her absolute, you know, best film, The Middle of Nowhere. And so there's always that tension, like, and we talked about this a little bit on this retreat, like, mm-hmm. Is it activism or art? You know, what should we fully invest in? And can we be doing that? Can there be this hybrid? And of course you can do meaningful work that has messages, but you can't be a full-time artist if you're being a full-time activist. And so what I find is that there are 2 or 3 years where I'm working on a project like that is a film. And then for 15 years, I'm doing like activism. And so you are what you do and how you spend your time. And I'm trying to shift back into filmmaking. Because I have so much confidence in this new generation. I feel like young people have it.
There is this new generation of activists and organizers that does feel like, uh-oh, something's about to happen. Talk about this moment that we're in right now.
Well, I mean, it's so exciting. And I don't know that I'm like the one to talk about it. Like, I really do trust that. And it's not another generation. These kids aren't young enough to be my children. They're like young enough to be my nieces. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're like 10, 15 years younger than me. And I am excited about their leadership. I'm excited about it growing. There are 50 BLM chapters. BYP 100 has all of these chapters. Today, they just shut down police stations. And what's amazing about them is that even as some of the horrific things that we've seen happen over the past couple of weeks, and with Dallas and with Baton Rouge, with the officers being targeted, that has not derailed their message about defunding police departments who have these bloated budgets because of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, all this money trickling down to places like Ferguson where they get friggin' tanks, mm-hmm. which they'll never need because they think one day Sharia law is coming or whatever. that's literally how they get this money, you know, because New York can't spend anymore. New York, as Million Hoodies told us, is the 7th largest army in the world.
Hey guys, it's Erica again, one of the politically reactive producers. So you know how Dream just said that the NYPD is the 7th largest army in the world? That's probably something you've heard before. In fact, maybe you heard it from former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
I have my own army in the NYPD, which is I'm the seventh biggest army in the world.
It's not quite right, though. The NYPD's 34,000 officers is nothing compared to South Korea's 630,000 active military, which, according to the International Institute for Strategic Studies, is the real seventh largest army in the world. But for people of color on the streets of New York, it sure can feel like the NYPD is an army, especially since it has submarine drones and the ability to shoot down planes. Anyway, back to the show.
It's all Homeland Security money, right?
Yeah, all New York. Yeah.
But places like Ferguson like have money for a tank. They're like, we should get a tank.
Yeah. Well, because it trickles down. They can't. Yeah. New York can't spend it all. Wow. New York and LA can't spend it all. So it then goes to all these other cities because we're going to continue to earmark this money for anti-terrorism.
Because we can tell Americans that we are fighting terror.
And that terror is the terror of Black people. You know, so they have not been derailed. And the first evidence of them not being derailed was when the Mike Brown video surfaced of him kind of mushing the store clerk in the face. Yeah. And the store clerk who later said he paid for his blunt. And he pushed me in the face. It reminded me actually of Big and the Arab guy who owned the store on Fulton. They used to always get into it and they'd be shoving back and forth. But they've known each other since Biggie was eight or whatever. You know what I mean? And they're going to keep knowing each other, you know? And so when that foot video surfaced, and Fox News and everyone tried to say, we told you he was a thug and therefore he deserved to be shot and lay in the ground for 4 hours and everything that happened. I saw that those kids didn't get derailed. And I said, wow, this is a different kind of movement. Because there was a time when media would float this counter narrative and then it would be shut down. Oh, man, we were out here fighting for a criminal or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And they would, but they disallowed that criminalizing of Black corpses. This idea that we should have a branch in our government called the execution branch, you know, which are basically policemen who aren't even required to have advanced degrees out in these streets, judge, jury, you know, everyone just executing people. And they said, no more. And so that's been an amazing movement. And I have utter faith in this generation kind of working it out, you know, and sustaining the movement. I don't think they're going to solve the problems, you know, but I invest in their leadership. I support in all kinds of ways behind the scenes. And I'm excited, you know, for a change.
I mean, you had, you know, said that you didn't feel like they were quite another generation because the gap is only about 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. But there is something to be said about the fact that there's all this technology that is being used that I feel like I don't know. And I'm only probably the same gap. And it's like, I don't know how to use that. I don't know how to use Snapchat. I don't know how to make Vine videos. I don't know how you use what you use to do.
That may just
doing.
Be you, though. That may just be.
Yeah, because Antonio French is definitely around my age. And he was the one who started Vining first. He ended up being problematic for different reasons.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
So Antonio French is currently an alderman, which is just an old English way of saying city council person, in St. Louis, Missouri's 21st Ward. He was on the scene in Ferguson taking videos and was actually arrested at one point. Here's one of the vines she was talking about. Okay, back to Dream.
Antonio French, the assemblyman in St. Louis, was the first one to float the vines.
Well, can we at least say that it's faster than the state can catch up with?
I wish. I think the state has young people working in their departments. And I mean, they've invested that part of that counterterrorism budget goes into turning hackers, like everything you see on friggin' what's the show that we all love about? With Frank
Underwood, House of Cards,
where they flip the hacker. I mean, the state has all of that at their disposal. Like they, I would think that their digital counterterrorism budget is quite sufficient, and I think that that's what these formations may not be prepared for. Like I was mentored by Black Liberation Army folks, Black Panther Party folks. Those were literally my mentors, right? Who gave me a political education. These kids are coming up in a post nonprofit era. So around 10, 15 years ago, nonprofits began investing in criminal justice and sometimes in policing, but racial justice issues, right? And that's a new phenomenon. So a lot of these kids are coming out of like a nonprofit, you know, kind of structure. So they've been trained by executive directors of nonprofits.
not by...
They're not ready for the state repression piece and surveillance piece. And they're not ready for what happens when the state labels your organization a terrorist or your movement a terrorist organization. And that is something that I actually keeps me up at night. It has had me on a bunch of strategy calls. And it concerns me.
Let's talk about what you a piece that you showed here. At this retreat, there's time for people, activists, and artists to get up and talk about the work they're working on. And you showed this piece that everybody, I think, was ready to go, can we tweet it out now? Yeah. It felt like a very sort of like a crystallization of everything we're talking about right now.
Well, we had 7 minutes to present what we're working on. And I presented a 3-minute and 40-second video that I did with Jay-Z. But I prefaced it by saying, I'm not sure I even believe in this anymore. But like,
that's right, you did. Which makes it even more Dream Hampton. That makes it even more. Now that I've spent 2 years making this, it's probably not what I should be doing.
10 months. And it was, okay. Yeah, it was with Molly Crabapple and Jay-Z, a video that we're going to release in September where he talks about the war on drugs. And what's great about it is that what people have been craving for a long time is for Jay to say something. You know, Jay, a long time ago, Lior Cohen, executive at Def Jam, partner of Russell Simmons, introduced him to a rabbi who taught him about the rabbinical concept of philanthropy, which is 7 levels of giving, and the 6th level is anonymous. The 7th is to teach a man to fish thing. So he's been at the anonymous level forever. Like, that's his lane. He loves that. He'll do things behind the scenes. He doesn't like people to say that he did it, you know, and so that's where he's comfortable. And a lot of people, including myself, have been like, wow, if you just said one thing, that'd be worth way more than this little 100 G's you just gave. Not that 100 G's is little. Yeah. I'd love 100 G's. So he did it. But at the same time, the reason I prefaced what I said by, I'm not sure this is important anymore, is because now more than ever, and maybe this was never true, but when we look at the civil rights movement, we have an idea of artists in some ways and celebs being part of the leadership. Yes. I mean, it's very much a we are the world model. You know what I mean? Where like celebrities kind of stand on a stage and tell you what's going on and invite you into the movement.
Sing the song, what's going on?
Right. But of course, that was never true. I mean, Marvin was being informed by the work of Dr. King and Malcolm, and Nina Simone. And of course, Dr. Belafonte was meeting with Stokely Carmichael and Kwame. You know, all of that was happening. Yeah. So in this moment, though, artists weren't saying shit, like, you know, celebs, musicians, particularly rappers, this was totally the syrup stage. You know, like, everyone was just openly being like, I'm a drug addict or a drug user at least. So that was the stage of hip hop we were in. It was very rock and roll, and that's just where, I'm not even being critical of it, it's just where we were. And the movement happened, you know, the rising up from Trayvon, but absolutely with Ferguson. And so now you're kind of playing yourself if you're not speaking up on the issues. So it's not like kids are following Kendrick. Kendrick is following the kids.
Yes.
I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015. Once I finish this, if you listen, then sure you will agree.
Like, the kids made Kendrick's Grammy performance not only possible, but necessary.
I'm African American. I'm African. I'm black as the moon. Heritage of a small village. Part of my residence.
So there used to be a price to pay for saying something. Someone like Harry Belafonte really didn't work after he spoke up.
Yeah.
And now I believe you are going to pay a price if you say nothing. So it's not like we need Jay-Z to say anything. But I will say that in terms of not preaching to the choir, the so-called masses, which I think I'm a part of, you know, there is still, there remains some relevance for celebrities. But I think the time is ticking on that, too. The clock is ticking on that.
I mean, but yeah, I think just to sort of to defend your work that you're now unfending.
Unfending.
That there, I always think about, like, there's a 12-year-old kid out there who's just like, I just like Jay-Z.
I don't think 12-year-old kids, they think he's Beyonce's husband.
But I'm saying, well, okay, there's somebody out there, maybe, that may be true.
I love Beyonce, so I'll listen to what her husband has to say.
I can't wait to hear what her husband has to say.
Not even, right. Yeah, no, he's
but
at I think, the
but
sunset.
I'm saying there's somebody out there, because he's so big, there is, or I'll put this, there's probably like a 45-year-old soccer mom in the suburbs who's like, I really like that Jay-Z, because, you know, because he's been around long enough that those songs have just sort of ended up in Walmarts,
right,
you know what I mean?
No, his voice is iconic, and the thing that we should describe about the video. It's him narrating an animated video that I hope to share with everyone in September, well, that we will share.
Yeah.
And
it's very much like, for people who've seen the story of Stuff, it's sort of a very condensed version about
kind of the war on drugs, mm-hmm. like sort of a very with a pictorial version of the war on drugs with Jay-Z narrating, and it's very
and Molly Crabapple, and Molly who's amazing.
Yeah, the art painting. Is amazing, and yeah. so and it's one of those things that it's just easy to watch and go, I'm going to put this on my Facebook. It begs to be shared,
right?
Even if it wasn't Jay-Z, even if it yeah. was like let's say Harry did the voiceover, yeah. it would still be shareable. But
but in that moment, you do recognize, and we talked about this after we screened it, you came up to me and we were both talking about how iconic Jay's voice is. I remember thinking that I was at some concert and he does that thing where he's backstage and he's like, yeah, yeah, or whatever, like doing his thing on the mic. And I was like, wow, your voice is very distinct. I always thought of it as kind of anemic. And he didn't have my favorite. He's not my favorite MC. You know, Biggie is, who has like a really full, robust voice and has all this information.
And this is somebody who hangs out with him. Right, Jay, right. Jay, your voice is kind of anemic. I mean, you've worked with it very well. You've accomplished some things.
I mean, yeah. We're not friends because I sit around and tell him how awesome he is. I think he's a great writer, but I think Biggie was a better storyteller. Mm-hmm. Like, what Jay does is he thinks out loud and he is able to have very truncated, brevity, the art of brevity, which we all may have, like, mastered with Twitter. Mm-hmm. Twitter helped me be more brief. But the most important thing about that video is that Jay is not only talking about how the war on drugs intersects with mass incarceration, but also how it's an economic equity issue, which means that we are being locked out of big marijuana. And big marijuana is one of the only growing industries in this friggin' country. We are selling debt.
Yes.
We are selling modified soybeans and corn. And we are one of our biggest top five crops is marijuana. It's one of the biggest growth industries. The entire state of California would have been my hometown, Detroit, if it wasn't for marijuana. And we have to be in this industry from the flower to the hemp to the oil.
And just the idea that the video talks about the fact that, you know, sort of the unequal application of drug laws and
Absolutely.
Drug sentencing law, and how white people get sentenced versus how black and brown people get sentenced.
Well, now that has been talked about before. But what Jay is bringing new to the conversation is how there are laws that prevent us from participating in the above ground marijuana industry, which is a $50 billion industry.
And those laws, because if you have a felony from selling marijuana, you can't now become a part of the above ground
Absolutely.
Industry.
As the prohibition on marijuana ends, there are going to be all these ways that we're locked out of it. And not just we as black people, brown people, but everyday people.
We is not big business.
Right.
Also, I hate the fact, like in Washington, like it's legal now, but the people who are in jail for weed are still in jail. Like that wasn't... It's not grandfathered.
Some laws and people are working to make sure each new law is, because it's a state by state campaign, you know, that Drug Policy Alliance has largely led, and they are the ones who partnered with us on this video with Jay. And, you know, so Prop 64, which is coming up in November, that you can vote on if you're a resident of California, which I am, and I absolutely will be voting yes on 64. And it has been written in a way that A, works retroactively so that people, I don't know if it's in the past 10 or 20 years, but people who are in prison for marijuana can now come out. So there'll be a lot of like releasing of folks, mm-hmm. which is something we're asking the president to do on his way out, to just do a mass pardon, to let the thousands of people out who are in there on drug offenses only to come out, you know? And then the second piece of the Prop 64 is removing the barrier that disallows felons from owning dispensaries.
Hold up, wait a minute.
And just to clarify, Prop 64 is primarily known as the Marijuana Legalization Bill for California. It's been voted on in the past and failed. California, we gotta do better this time.
And just an update on President Obama commuting prisoners. Just last week, he commuted the sentence for 214 federal inmates, the most in a single day since at least 1900. Most of them were serving for nonviolent drug offenses, and 67 of them have been serving life sentences. He's up to 562 total, more than the past nine presidents combined, and plans to continue.
Can he run for a third term?
You want him to Bloomberg it?
You work a lot with Jay-Z, so can you tell us how that happened?
Yeah, well, I don't want my whole life to be about friggin' Jay-Z, but, yeah. And this is for the air. I mean, I'm not asking you to edit this. My whole life isn't about Jay. When I met Jay, I'd been writing for 6 years. I was a journalist that he wanted me to hear his new album, Reasonable Doubt, people weren't interested in it. People were interested in Mace. Everyone thought that Mace. That's exactly.
Oh, that era.
Yeah. I mean, Reasonable Doubt did not go platinum. I doubt it went gold.
It's probably gone by now.
For sure. Saying for the good 5 years after it was released, it didn't go platinum. Yeah. And I heard it, and I remember me and Biggie were listening to it, and I was like, yo, this kid is really witty, and he works with space in a really interesting way. Like, he leaves a lot of space open and whatever. I just like that kind of stuff. And he, and so I wrote about it. I went to the Village Voice and I pitched them a story. I said, yo, I want to review this kid from Brooklyn, Jay-Z's debut album, Reasonable Doubt. And they were like, well, he's not big enough. If you want to review it, you have to review it with Nas's second album, It Was Written. And so I did a double review called Ice Ice Baby, which is on my site, dreamhampton.com. And I read it because it's the 20th anniversary of Reasonable Doubt. And I recently read it because kids were tweeting it out. And I was like, wow, this holds up. So that's how I met Jay. So he called me. He said, I felt really understood after he read my thing in the Village Voice. And so, and I said, yeah, I'm from Detroit. I totally understand drug dealers. And so, then Biggie died right after. And so we kind of bonded on becoming friends. You know, I was really obsessed with like finding Biggie's killer and like killing him. And Jay like talked me off that ledge or whatever.
That's easy. Let that slip out.
I like how your life is a tall tale that's real.
Yes.
That is.
Yeah.
We could keep you here forever, and I certainly want to say personally, I hope that we have more of these talks on and off mics. But I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to come here and do this with us. This has been great, and it's an honor and a pleasure.
I feel the same way. I'm so happy for your success.
Oh no, thank you. I was sort of booking Dream for the show, and I was like, asking, hey, would you like to please be on the thing? She's like, do you remember we met at the going to the border? I was like, yeah, I also remember that you saw me bombing Detroit in front of 20 people.
Bomb because it's 20 people. You guys are great.
It was like
you,
a venue NATO. That held 300 people, and there was 20 people there. And that's my dream. I was like, it was really hard. I was like, maybe she's forgotten about it. Hey, you know, that was a different dude. That was a different dude.
Same hair. Yeah. It's great to see someone have Frederick Douglass hair on television. Today.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's funny. You get confused for a lot of black celebrities. It would be great Frederick Douglass.
The ghost of Frederick Douglass. I would like to play him in the movie, but we can talk about that. Maybe you want to
Frederick Douglass, by the way, was fine. Like, I used to have a poster in my room of Frederick Douglass, and it was like, yeah, that was it. I would just go to sleep looking at fine ass Frederick Douglass.
One of my favorite little Frederick Douglass anecdotes is that apparently John. Well, you know, when I was hanging out with Frederick Douglass, apparently John Brown like told him about his campaign, what he was planning to do, and Frederick Douglass was apparently like, yeah, I don't think I can be a part of that. I don't think that's a very interesting idea, but maybe I just love the idea that he approached us. Assuming Frederick Douglass is, let's get ourselves killed.
Let's go get some guns and martyr ourselves. Nah.
Well, you know, maybe it's best if you do that. Now I'll just keep writing.
I'm working on my third autobiography. I can't squeeze that in right now.
Can that be the last note? We need more John Browns. We need, and there were societies that were formed in his name. There were the White Panthers by John Sinclair. And that is what we need. And I'm heartened when I see, you know, white people on the front lines, particularly in New York during these last couple of shootings, Union Square, Times Square. It was a whole bunch of white freedom fighters. Because once you move from ally to a freedom fighter, like then we're cooking with gas. And none of this is going to change in America if it's just a bunch of mad people of color. Yes. Like it really has to be white people who say, actually, the job of the police is not to execute people in the street if they wiggle.
Yes.
If they run, even if they punch me in my face.
Yes.
Like
my job is to de-escalate every situation.
And so until white people are having those conversations amongst themselves, nothing's going to change. So
I agree. I think we need some John Brown white people to put their bodies on the line to go to prison to die for the movement, and we as people of color can like tweet about it and write blogs
and send out the video.
Yeah. I think it's time we reverse things a little bit.
Yeah, that's so never going to happen. But it would be cool.
Did you see George Clooney?
Rest in peace.
Oh, my God.
You guys are awful. Well, that's thank good. You again.
Thank you.
The Honorable Dream Hampton.
The Honorable.
Hurry. So what did we learn today?
We learned that Dream Hampton has a pilot's license, which is a very useful thing for the revolution.
We've also learned that you will not be useful in the revolution.
Well, we knew that.
I'm big. I can carry stuff.
We also learned that mentioning Mace is still hilarious.
Oh, poor Mace.
Oh, Mace.
Rest in Puffy. I also learned that Dream Hampton feels like the real-life embodiment of the Oracle from the Matrix movies.
I also learned that Dream was good friends with the Notorious B.I.G.
I learned that Shakespeare is a woman. I think I learned that. I'm going to have to do some more Googling, but I trust Dream, but I'm looking up some more.
And I learned that Dream Hampton agrees with my political philosophy that we need more John Brown white people.
White people, get some guns. No, not you white people. The white people who don't have guns, who are afraid of guns. You get guns. Other white people, give your guns to the white people I'm talking to right now.
And I learned that if you're friends with Dream Hampton, it does not matter if you're a billionaire rap mogul who's married to Beyonce. If she thinks your voice sounds anemic, she's going to say that your voice sounds anemic.
Well, that's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to all who have commented on Twitter using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive. We've gotten some good feedback and good show ideas. We'll address some of your questions soon, so keep them coming.
And if you haven't done so, hit that subscribe button on whatever you're using to listen to this. And maybe think about leaving us a nice little review. It has been very helpful in getting the word out. So thanks to those who've already done so.
And if you're really feeling us, check out some of our other projects. I've got two other podcasts, Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period, and my live radio show and podcast, Come Out Right Now. And I'm going on tour, Boston, New York, D.C., Portland, some other places. Check out my site for all the dates, wkamalbell.com.
And I have a new album out on Kill Rock Stars called Mainstream American Comic, which you can get on Amazon or iTunes. I'm also still on tour, and you can see me at Salt Lake City on August 16th, San Diego on August 17th, and Burlington, Vermont the week after. And if you get the chance, maybe write Hank Azaria a little note on Twitter, reminding him that it would be really cool if he appeared in my Apu documentary. Be nice, tell him how much you love him, and tell him how much I love him.
Politically Reactive is a production of First Look Media and distributed by Panoply. The team includes Nick Bornstein, Lisa Leingang, Erica Mu, and Max Jacobs. The show is engineered by Ted Muldoon.
Thanks again to Dream Hampton for joining us today. You can find more info about her writing, films, and other projects at dreamhampton.com. You can actually watch her films for free there. Very, very cool. Please check them out.
And thanks again to the Opportunity Agenda for hosting their 2016 Creative Change Retreat and letting us do our podcast there. And letting our producers come too. They got a nice room. Thanks to Northgate Studios in Berkeley and AudioLink LA for their studios this week. And thanks to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show.